or an article discussion to go over. And so I hope everybody got a chance to look at the article that was sent regarding malignancy and chronic leg ulcers. But before we have a chance to talk about that, I do want to let everybody know that next month's call will be scheduled for March 23rd. So if there is anybody interested in presenting or looking for an article for discussion, always welcome volunteers. It is something that eventually we'll ask everybody to participate and give a brief presentation. But one individual has already volunteered for next month, but we still need a another. So if it's something that you'd like to do next month, the call will be scheduled for March 23rd, and hopefully you've already gotten the calendar invite for that. One thing to bring of note to everybody, some of you may know this and some of you may not have been exposed to this, but in the past we have looked at a product called Miro 3D. This was a three-dimensional porcine collagen matrix that was something that we were looking into being able to provide for everybody for use for their patients. And this was basically something that was followed the same inclusion criteria as biologics. Unfortunately, we had some contract issues that didn't allow us to proceed, but those have been kind of resolved. So we're happy and hopeful to be able to release this in the near future. We'll certainly have another session where we'll have the folks from Reprise come to speak about their product. But the main advantage of this biologic is that it's a three-dimensional scaffold. So for those wounds that are more cavitary, that have undermining, that have tunneling, this is probably the better option. Again, the inclusion-exclusion criteria are the same as before, but it's just a different type of product. One thing that I think is also worth mentioning is that because this is a porcine product, it's probably not it might be a little bit presumptuous to assume that certain people may not accept this just for religious purposes. Although there are a number of religions that don't consume pork products, for health purposes, sometimes those aren't treated the same way. So, if this ultimately is a product that you are considering for a patient, do have that frank discussion with them, inform them, educate them of, the source, and, really go over that, those criteria with them. And that's something that should be done regardless, just, in terms of, informed consent, but don't make assumptions on your own without having that discussion with the patient and making sure that they are not interested in that product. So it's something I'm excited to kind of reintroduce to our patient population, but we'll have more information on that from Reprise. Any questions about any of those things? All right, another item to go over, just a reminder that any scheduling or rescheduling of any rounds, skin sweeps, anything else really is something that needs to be managed and handled by your regional manager. Understand that there are a number of individuals that do need to be aware of when these schedule changes take place, not necessarily just you and the treatment nurse. So, again, we don't want this to be something that you have to worry about. Put that on your regional manager's plate. They'll take care of it. They'll make sure all of the proper people are aware of that. And so, we don't want any sort of negative consequences happening from schedule changes that just happen without all of the people being notified about that. So, Milt, I know on the last call you had a few comments to make about that. I'll turn it over to you.
Yeah, so a lot of times when a provider feels that the nurse that they're dealing with and them have come to an agreement and everything is fine as far as making a change on the schedule, it's not always fine because maybe the DON is not on board with it and it has staffing plans that are different. The administrator. And invariably, when this happens, we end up getting reamed out that it didn't go through all the proper channels. And we've even had facilities terminate over this because it wasn't necessary.
Get out. Get, why are you in the bed now naked? With the butts, the dirty butts.
Hello, somebody needs to.
Mute.
Yes. Anyway, but it is really important to make sure your regional manager director knows about this so that they can make sure it's really been cleared. Again, if the treatment nurse says it's fine, it doesn't mean it's fine. That's not sufficient. And when they get challenged by their higher ups, like what happened, doctor or provider so and so didn't show, and they say, oh, it got moved, and they say, who authorized that? They'll throw you under the bus. They will not ever take the blame themselves, because they could get in trouble. So do not count on that. And we've literally had terminations over this issue. So make sure that your regional manager is always in the loop on that. They will do their best to try to accommodate your time, and make sure it works for the facility. But this way, it goes through all the proper channels and there are no negative consequences. So it's just very important to follow that process. That's it for me on that.
Any questions about any of those issues so far? All right. The last thing that I wanted to go over is with regards to sometimes pressure that you may get from facilities to reclassify wounds. This comes up every now and then, and I think we've kind of hit that cycle again where we've encountered a number of individuals where they've been asked to reclassify wounds from pressure to some sort of other etiology. It's one thing if you agree or perhaps are on the fence about a diagnosis, but sometimes, unfortunately, facilities outright just ask for things to be changed that may not necessarily be clinically justified. When those types of situations or scenarios occur, it is very important to notify us at the corporate office about these. That includes, letting your regional managers know, the education team know, myself know, because, this is not acceptable. We don't want people changing things just because they were pressured to or asked to, if that's really not your clinical judgment and that's not really the appropriate diagnosis, then, putting anything other than that is fraudulent. That becomes a liability for you, it becomes a liability for the practice, and it's just not, what we're here to do. Now, again, there are scenarios where perhaps you're doing a workup, you're trying to figure out the diagnosis. Those circumstances are understandable. But again, there are instances where, outright our providers are being asked to change specifically from pressure to some sort of other diagnosis, and we need to know about that. There are steps and measures that, we can and will take, but it really requires a discussion of all of these individuals that I mentioned. And so, Milt, I will again turn it over to you for your input.
Yeah, so it's really critically important that you stick to what your belief is, your medical judgment. One of the providers on the prior call asked about what if you agree with the request because, from a medical perspective, it was okay. That's Dr. Karamani can speak to that again. That's okay. That's not the issue. The issue is sometimes someone to try to make themselves or their facility look better wants you to change something that is not correct and that it is not real. And we cannot condone that. We can't agree to that. We had a provider years ago. This was in California, where they were pressured a number of times about changing, not calling something a pressure injury, and they would reject that pressure until one time they capitulated. And that one time that they capitulated to help this facility, it happens to be that a surveyor came in subsequently, within a day or two of that. And the surveyor said, no way that this was not a pressure injury, failed the facility on the survey and said, that they were being fraudulent in their documentation. And the result, the facility then blamed us for changing it. And then that provider lost, and this provider had six, seven, or eight facilities with that particular company, lost all of them because of doing that. And then ultimately, we lost that provider because there was no business. So you don't want to get into that. Your license is on the line, and we got to document the right things. We've got to call it what it is. Dr. Karamani can speak to the other.
Yeah, so again, as I mentioned, if you're unsure of the diagnosis and you're still in need of doing workup and testing to kind of narrow down the etiology, that's one thing. But we don't want individuals changing diagnosis just for the sake of changing diagnosis. So I will stop there and see if anybody else has any questions about any of the things brought up so far.
Sorry, I jumped on like a couple minutes late and I think somehow got unmuted running after children. So I apologize about that. But can you also just in like a brief sentence review the first issue or two that I might have missed before this past one?
Sure. So just real quick, next month's meeting will take place on March 23rd. We're looking for a presenter for the evening, the later of the two calls. So if you are interested in volunteering for that session, that's still open. We're also going to be bringing or talking more about the Miro 3D product that we've introduced maybe about a year or so ago, maybe a little bit longer than that. It was a 3D porcine collagen. Inclusion and exclusion criteria are the same as all of the other biologics, but this is a 3D product that's intended for more kind of as a space occupying graft versus some of the other flat biologics that you've seen. So areas that have undermining, that are cavitary, that have tunneling, that's kind of where that product is ideal for. Other than that, let's see here. Any scheduling or rescheduling needs to be done through your RM. And that was all of the issues that were discussed previously.
Oh, so we have lost facilities over scheduling with the RM. That was one of the things.
No, we lost facilities because if the provider,
Reclassifying.
no, also scheduling, if the provider
Scheduling.
is reliant on the, let's say, the treatment nurse, and you think you've worked it out, and it hasn't been cleared all the way up the food chain, we've lost facilities over that because,
Understood.
yeah, because
Got
DON disagrees, and because it affects their staffing, or the administrator, there could be all kinds of reasons, and We've been told you don't rely on that. If you have a schedule, you get all the proper channels, and we'll work to help you get that done when you need to, but we want to clear it through all the proper channels. And that treatment nurse is not going to do that. Communications within these facilities is notoriously poor.
Got it. Thank you so much.
No problem. Milt, did you have any other agenda items to go over?
Nope.
All right. Melissa, I will turn it over to you.
Good evening, everybody. I just want to start by reminding everybody that MIPS 2026 is live. They're the same measures that we used for 2020. 2026 are the same for 2025. My second item is making sure that you're completing your documentation and providing it in a respectable fashion to the facility. We've recently had an uptake in the complaints about, facilities getting notes 3, 4, 5 days a week later. The company's expectation is that all notes are to be batch printed and to be provided before you leave the facility. You can leave a note incomplete if you have to go back and do anything with one of the comprehensive tabs and still batch print your note. But the company's expectation is that everybody provide their notes before they leave the facility. Stephanie Finkenthal has now joined the call. She'll be on all of these calls. She's been promoted to the Director of Wound Education. So I'm going to let her take it over. And okay,
Okay.
Steph.
Good evening. I just wanted to touch base with all of you and remind you that now the same stables and the declines need to be addressed. They are no longer FYIs. So if you have a same stable that third week in a row, you need to fix it and do something different. And also the declines, you need to address those immediately. The other thing that I wanted to touch base with, you guys will be seeing when you get your audits that we've added a little bit more that you need to complete on that new form. There was the community acquired, and then there was the type of drainage. There is also a box, and it's not mandatory, but it is mandatory. It doesn't make it mandatory that you check it depending on what type of product you use, whether it is autolytic, enzymatic, or mechanical debridement. That means even if you type it in down in the additional treatment section, you need to make sure that you're checking that box. Or, for example, you check that sample box, you need to check the enzymatic box. Any questions? Okay, thank you so much.
All right, I'm not sure if everybody heard that or not, but I just wanted to clarify the type of debridement is specifically for full thickness wounds. So if it's a partial thickness, then it's it wouldn't be required. But without further ado, Dr. Cardin, I will turn the floor over to you to start our
Okay.
discussion for the article.
Thanks, Dr. Karamani. I picked an article from JAMA Dermatology way back June 2012 called Malignancy and Chronic Leg Ulcers: The Value of Systemic Wound Biopsies. It's a prospective multicenter cross-sectional study. Cross-sectional means that it will select a population and follow it. Before I summarize the article, I'm going to assume that maybe some of you haven't had a chance to look at it. I'll just present a short case that made me think about this, which is I have a patient that's 85, and I've been taking care of her for over 4 years. She has a medial malleal wound that doesn't heal. She has venous stasis disease. She likes to keep her feet down, and I thought about it possibly being mixed because of that. But her ABI is 1.2. The wound has gotten better as I have debrided it. Every week there's slough. I clean it up every week. I did do biografts on it for 10 times and got the wound almost to heal. And then it recurred. There's nothing heaped up in the middle of the wound. It's a typical venous appearing ulcer, but it is about half a centimeter deep. Well, since here I was following this thing forever, I thought maybe I should get that biopsied. And that's what prompted me to look at this article. I started looking at some other articles that were really esoteric and they would have bored the teeth off of all of us. But this one I thought was kind of interesting because it was pretty clinical and easy to read. Typical JAMA article. So the objective that these folks that did this in the main central hospital in Paris. So it's a French article translated into English, was to determine the frequency of skin cancers in chronic leg ulcers. So they looked at, they were able to get 144 patients. These were referred in from 17 dermatology departments throughout the Paris area. And they looked at how many patients developed cancer in these ulcers. So of the 144 patients, there were actually 154 ulcers. And the cancer rate was, I was taken aback, 10.4%. Now, that prompted me to think back about marginal ulcers. I had learned that marginal ulcers don't occur unless they're about 30 years old, that they occur in scars and more frequently in burns. And in fact, one of the reasons they like excising burns, besides diminishing the square area of the wound and increasing healing and decreasing infection and all that, is also to prevent the development of a marginal ulcer. In this article, they seem to kind of compare chronic leg ulcers with cancer as marginal ulcers. And so that might be a criticism of the article, because I look at a marginal ulcer as something formed in a scar. In any case, of these 154 leg ulcers, most of them were vascular. Most of them were venous. There were 9 squamous cell cancers, 5 basal cell cancers, 1 melanoma, and 1 leiomyosarc. The overwhelming majority of them had lasted over 3 years, like my patient. Now, with my patient, I have tried to get her to go to derm, but I'm not sure I will achieve that. Well, I'm trying. It's hard for dermatologists to want to take nursing home patients with, the typical insurance. But maybe we'll be successful. One thing about this article that kind of skews it, I think, is that most of these patients had findings that were suspicious of cancer, and that means that there was an exophytic mass in the base of the wound. And so it wasn't just all comers, just routine garden variety leg ulcers, all forming 10% cancer. That's not typical. these patients were referred in by dermatologists, and so they all had high suspicion that there were cancers in the wounds. In any case, like I said, it's food for thought. For inclusion, all of these wounds had to have increased in size over the prior 3 months prior to being accepted into the study. Well, my patient's wound has waxed and waned. It did get larger. There was one episode when she had cellulitis, which I treated with antibiotics that resolved. And once the wound was cleaned up and the cellulitis taken care of, the wound began to decrease in size, you know, pointing, I think, against a malignancy, but not assuring me of that. They took various patients out of being looked at if they had pyoderma gangrenosum, which is, you know, seen in Crohn's disease or ulcerative colitis or some other collagen vascular disease, patients with vasculitis, hypertensive leg ulcers, calciphylaxis, or uncontrolled heart failure and kidney disease and liver disease. Patients that were using immunosuppressants weren't included either. So they used the ABI as their main way of screening the patients. And then they did two biopsies. These were punch biopsies, one at the edge of the wound and one at the middle portion of the wound. There's a little statement in the article that said that when they biopsied these patients, they healed nicely. There wasn't a problem. And I actually looked at that. I wanted to see what happens to chronic wounds that you're having a hard time healing, and then you go and cut something out of it. How does that affect the wound? And I actually found an article that said that the wounds did better. So, you know, if you're looking at a patient and you're thinking to yourself, maybe this patient needs to be biopsied, don't worry. It's not going to adversely affect the wound. So we looked at the fact that, you know, these patients developed these cancers. And another aspect, which I thought was interesting, is that aside from having an exophytic lesion that looked malignant, one of the findings was if they had heaped up granulation tissue at the margin, at the edge. That seems to be something that was seen in most of the patients. And I don't see that in my patient. I don't see exuberant granulation. In any case, what do you guys think? When do you biopsy a chronic wound? That's the real question I want to answer from having read this article. The article recommends 3 months, but you know, they're dermatologists and they want you to refer. But I'm just not certain that squares with the classic marginal ulcer that takes 30 years to form. So what is appropriate? Is it 3 months? Is it 6 weeks? What do you guys think? When do you refer a chronic wound that isn't doing well to a dermatologist for a biopsy? Don't speak all at once.
Hi, it's Gail Salganik. I've actually found a couple of these in the past, and it hasn't been with patients who were longstanding chronic over 30 year kind of things. It was certainly patients that had been seeing it longer, like longstanding meaning like 2 to 3 year long wounds. I will say that in both of the patients in which I found the cancer, and it was squamous both times, they kind of did have the rolled up, heaped up edges that to me just kind of looked like it. But I will say that my threshold for biopsy, and I do the biopsy myself, I don't refer out unless it's in some tricky part of the body.
Where do you send it to, Gail?
You know, I've actually set up, are you here in California?
Yeah.
I've actually set up, you know, with the assistance through Stephanie to, what is the name of the company? But we have a company we can send it to.
Trident.
Yeah. What's that?
Is it Trident?
It's Sages.
Sages, that's it.
Oh, Sages, okay.
Yeah. And they're actually really very good. The turnaround is real fast. I even knew one of the pathologists. So it's like, oh, great. Awesome. So.
And did you use a punch like these guys in this study or how'd you do it?
I do it right at, I try to catch a little bit of what looks like some normal-ish margin. So I do try to get at the edge, but I take a big chunk, and sometimes I'll take bigger than just the punch biopsy. I'd like to get a full thickness one.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. If I'm suspicious though for melanoma, that one I'm sending out.
Yeah.
But like I said, most of them look more like the basal cell kind of rodent ulcer or have that kind of heaped up edge that looks ratty.
Right.
Of squamous. I mean, my threshold is actually pretty low in a lot of my chronic wounds. But I look at chronic to me as like I've been dealing with this for over a year and I can't stand it anymore. Just made no progress.
So you're looking at a year or clinical signs heaped up or excessive.
Yes, and one of them was a patient I adopted from somebody else who had been treating it for 2 years. Well, the other one I had been treating for over a year.
Okay. Anybody else have any idea about when? Clearly, I think I should have biopsied this earlier, but anybody else have any ideas about when they routinely will biopsy something that doesn't look malignant?
You know, I think part of the determination for timeline or time frame also should be dependent on the body part. I know this article specifically, we're talking about the lower extremities, but when you're talking about, you know, chronic wounds in general and the marginal ulcers, you know, I think, you know, one of the points that the article made was the fact that these were all sun exposed areas. So,
oh, yeah, that's right.
That factor that, you know, may lead to a higher incidence of malignancy. Now, granted that this article, they were a, you know, tertiary care center and they were getting, you know, probably a higher rate of, you know, cancer patients in general. But I think, you know, for people that might be, you know, more active, that are, you know, more outdoors, you know, having that higher level of sun exposure certainly increases their risk. And I think, you know, the article did mention that, you know, some of those folks that, you know, did have positive cancers, you know, also did have perhaps more sun exposure. So, you know, if that's kind of the stereotype that this particular patient is falling under, then, you know, maybe that threshold to biopsy should come sooner rather than later.
Well, my patient has been in a bikini, but I think it was in around 1938.
Well, then we still had the ozone layer back then, so she was probably okay.
Anybody else have any other? I'm interested in knowing if there's a hard and set time, because the literature I've looked at really looks at 3 months as a sort of you better biopsy it at this point. And I thought that was curious to me because, you know, it seemed short. Well, what do people think about that?
I personally think that's a bit aggressive as well. You know, we know that you know, especially in a known patient that has venous insufficiency, especially our patient population. Maybe I shouldn't speak for everybody's patients, but I know I have the hardest time in general to have my patients use any sort of compression garments.
Right.
And we know that, you know, long-term has been one of the few things to help lessen recurrence of venous disease. So, you know, to biopsy all of these patients every 3 months, knowing that they're going to have, you know, cycles of regression and recurrence, you know, I think would be excessive, but that's, you know, perhaps that's my patient population that might be different than others. So, you know, what have others experienced?
Yeah, I would say compression is the gold. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. Go ahead.
Well, no, it's okay. I was going to say, thank you for the article. It's a great article. I completely agree with Dr. Karamadi. I deal with a patient population where I have a hard time. I have a hard time getting them to do anything that they need to do to help heal their wounds, including compression and elevation. And I often have a hard time even knowing if my treatments are being done as they're supposed to.
Right.
I had a patient with terrible venous ulcers on both lower extremities who I was following for years. And this patient lived in a recliner, like when they slept during the day and night, whatever, never left the recliner. And then one day, somebody somehow managed to convince her to get into bed on a Friday evening. And when I followed up with her on Tuesday, her legs were healed.
Yeah.
I do have patients that I have sent out to dermatology and I would do it immediately if a wound looked suspicious, and I've had wounds that just immediately look suspicious, but it's tough for me to say, oh, 3 months and you're going to dermatology. I also tend to have a really, really difficult time getting patients to any sort of specialist at all.
You know, I think that's a good point. If you're not comfortable doing a biopsy, then that, you know, is something to perhaps ask to be taught. You know, currently to get into a dermatologist's office could be, you know, months. You know, you don't want to sit on a cancer for that long of a period. Certainly if it's, you know, an aggressive form of cancer that's going to need, you know, immediate treatment. So, you know, if you do have that high index of suspicion, and you know you're waiting a long time, especially if you have a high, perhaps, you know, Medicaid population that, you know, many dermatologists not you know, won't be in network, then, you know, that's something that you may want to take that patient yourself and do that biopsy so that there's no delay in treatment.
Yeah, Gail, I really appreciate what you said, and I'm going to get with Stephanie about that, because I think I would feel comfortable biopsying it, and trying to get these people into derm is really tough.
Yeah, it's essential, and I like I said, it's a great program. Like I love this company.
This company just in California, or available in New York State?
They're nationwide.
If anybody's interested in the program, I can get you set up if you want to email me, and I will send the information out, and I will have them get in touch with you.
Oh, that's great. Thank you.
You're welcome.
In regards to the different tools you guys use for these biopsies, like I saw someone said they use a punch biopsy. Do you guys just use your debridement kits that AmeriWound offers to, you know, to do to do biopsies, or what are you guys using exactly? I have actually been in contact with the biopsy company, and they sent me cups, but they don't send any tools.
Yeah, they're actually, it's really easy. There's a punch biopsy tool, which is I use one that's at least 5 millimeters in size. It's just kind of a round. You know, it's kind of like a curette, but it goes straight down. The thing that you'll need is a pair of scissors to cut it out from the base. And then they send you the cup with the formalin.
You've ever used
we
those?
Can send any. We can send any provider a punch biopsy tool. That's not. You just have to let us know that you need it, or that you want them. But we can provide those. That's not a problem.
Great.
If you've ever cored an apple, it's essentially doing that. You've got this, you know, blade that's a cylinder, and you essentially just kind of twist it down or push it down onto the tissue until you have a cylinder of tissue. And like Dr. Salganik mentioned, you just clip the base of it, and there's your sample.
And you guys typically do that for like arms and legs, maybe like butts and backs. But what if they had like face or like, you know, something more cosmetic? What would you guys do?
Yeah, again, that, you know, when it gets to the face, it's a lot trickier. So I've done things on the temple. When it comes to the face, I'm actually using my scalpel and forceps. I'm not using the punch biopsy tool because I can't get as nice a cosmetic result because it's round, and putting in a stitch after that is not as pretty as an elliptical incision. But if it's in a sensitive area, like a nasolabial fold, it's on the nose, near the eyelid, I'm sending them out. I'm not, you know, and I get on the horn and talk to a dermatologist personally and tell them to squeeze them in.
All right. Any other comments? Well, thank you, Dr. Cardin. That was a good article and a great discussion. I appreciate everybody's input and insight. Again, open the floor for any additional questions or comments about this evening's topics. All right. Again, thank you all for attending. Again, do need a presenter for next month's late call, which is this call. So if anybody's interested, please reach out to myself or Melissa or Stephanie. Good night, everybody.
Night.
Good night. Thank you.
Thanks, everybody.
Good night. Bye.